From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
Our immigration system is a system that's about family relationships.
So how do we define family now after the recent Supreme Court decisions on marriage equality? We look at the impact on Latinos who are immigrants and gay. And then another dual identity, as Ramadan is set to begin, a conversation about being Latino and Muslim.
Being a Latina and a Muslim is not a dichotomy.
Another conversation in our series on Latino identity called Somos, Who We Are. And we hear about the passionate love between a man and his accordion.
As soon as I get home, nobody sleeps about 3 or 4 days, trying to play and trying to play.
Eduardo G. Carvalho on the Brazilian music style called Forró. All this and more coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Quédense con nosotros. Stay with us. It's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And we want to start by taking a look at immigrants, the Supreme Court, and the Defense of Marriage Act, or DOMA.
On June 26, we heard that finally DOMA fell. From that day, 26 at 10 a.m., I began to feel like a normal person, a common person.
The story now, in their own words, of Pablo Garcia Gámez and his husband, New York native Santiago Ortiz.
We met in Caracas 23 years ago. I had gone there to seek medical attention because I had HIV and there were no medications available at that time. And then one night I went out, met Pablo. We hit it off immediately, and the next day we went sightseeing and we spent that whole week together. I met his mother. And I asked him to come to New York, and he got here in March of 1992.
I spent the first year with documents, but the document expired a year later, and I decided to stay here illegally.
1 year turned into 22 years. We've been married for the last 2 years, but we've been together for 23 years. We had submitted his application for a green card, and it was denied solely on the basis that we were a same-sex couple. They didn't consider any of the value of our marriage or anything like that.
It was law, but it wasn't justice.
It was like, well, we're used to not deserving things because that's the way we were brought up. You know, oh, you're gay, you don't deserve the same things, you're second-class citizen. And slowly, we've come to realize, along with the rest of the nation, that no, there's nothing wrong about us, there's nothing weird about us. We're just two loving persons.
For me, it's amazing how things changed in 20 years. 20 years ago, it would be so difficult to say that I was gay or I was married with another man. No? I'm happy that the country where I'm living recognized me like a human being in the whole acceptance of the world.
It's overwhelming to be accepted by other people and to be seen as just regular people. And there's still a lot to be done. But for us, it's a time of a lot of happiness.
Queens, New York residents Pablo Garcia Gámez and Santiago Ortiz on how the Supreme Court striking down the Defense of Marriage Act has already changed their lives. They hope to hear about the status of Pablo's green card application this month, and Pablo plans to start teaching college Spanish in the fall. Here to talk a little bit more about this historic ruling and what it means for immigrants in same-sex marriages is Rachel Tiven. She's the executive director of the legal advocacy organization Immigration Equality. Welcome to Latino USA, Rachel.
It's such a pleasure to be here.
Okay, Rachel, so we just heard the story of Pablo and Santiago, one of hundreds of thousands of same-sex couples that will now be able to access the same immigration benefits as straight married couples. So explain, how is it that the DOMA ruling in the Supreme Court opens this door?
Until the Supreme Court ruled, Pablo and Santiago were seen as total strangers to one another by the federal government. The Defense of Marriage Act prohibited them from getting immigration benefits. And immigration benefits are totally federal. It's the federal government that gives out green cards. It's the federal government that decides whether or not you get deported.
And up until that Supreme Court ruling, there essentially would have been no way for them to ever apply for immigration papers because of the fact that their marriage essentially was not being recognized on a federal level.
Correct. And what's important to think about is our immigration system is a system that's about family relationships. Family is what determines whether someone who's in deportation proceedings can somehow get themselves out. There are lots of things when you're in court where if you can show a relationship to an American family member, you can get relief from deportation. That's a family relationship. So until June 26th, that was completely unavailable to lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender families.
The weekend after the ruling, the LA Times ran this headline, same-sex couples flood immigration offices for green cards. So how true is this? I mean, is it in fact that people are flooding, that the gates are open, that there is this immediate sense of, oh, we're undocumented, but we're gay and we're married. Now we can go walk into an immigration office without fear?
Well, you know, I think that one of the reasons that recognition by the federal government is so important for gay couples who have an immigration issue is that marriage is essentially the only way that someone who is currently undocumented, until we pass immigration reform, it is the only way that someone who is undocumented can get into status. So it's such a plum for that reason. It was so excruciating that gay couples were excluded from that. At Gay Pride this year, I got one of the biggest hugs I have ever gotten in my life from a couple, one from Argentina, who's a naturalized U.S. citizen, one from Peru, and he has been undocumented for many, many years, staying here to be with the person he loves. And he hugged me and he was crying because now he's going to get to see his family.
Rachel Tiven is Executive Director of Immigration Equality, and thanks to Pablo and Santiago for sharing their story with us. If you'd like to hear their entire story, and it's pretty wonderful, go to latinousa.org. Albóndiga, ojalá, ajedrez. All of these are Spanish words, but they come out of the intersection between the Spanish world and the Muslim world. But what does that intersection look like now, here in the United States? As the Muslim holy month of Ramadan begins on July 9th, we wanted to take a look into what it's like to be Latino and Muslim. As part of our series of conversations on Latinos and identity, a series we call Somos, who we are. We have three guests joining us on Latino USA. First is Hazel Gomez. She's a community organizer who focuses on immigration and criminal justice reform, and she joins us from WDET in Detroit, Michigan. Welcome, Hazel.
Hi, thank you so much for letting me be here.
Also joining us is Hamza Perez. He's a rapper, an activist, and the subject of the 2009 documentary, The New Muslim Cool. He's at WESA in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hola, Hamza.
¿Cómo está, María?
Bien, bien. And also joining us is Wilfredo Amr Ruiz. He's an attorney, a political analyst, and a Muslim chaplain. And he joins us from WLRN in Miami. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be with all of you. Thanks again for joining us on Latino USA.
Wa alaikum salam.
So the first thing that I thought of, you know, is that reaction when you come home. I can imagine what would have happened in my own home if I would have come home and said, Mami, papi, me volví musulmana. You know, I became a Muslim. And they probably would have said, like, and you, what? Wilfredo, what about you?
Maria, to me, it was shocking because my mother was a Eucharistic minister. The way she reacted is that she wouldn't speak to me for months. And I wondered if she ever heard that I was doing drugs or drinking alcohol, she wouldn't stop talking to me or addressing me. But when she learned I was a Muslim, she wouldn't talk to me for months.
I put my grandma and my grandpa in a room, and I said, Mama, Papa, I became Muslim today. And my grandfather just starts bawling his eyes out. My grandmother is infuriated. Estaba rabiosa. She leaves the room, and she's like, how dare you not believe in God anymore? And I was like, that's the complete opposite. And one of the beauties about taking the Shahada is all you have to say is, I believe that there is one God, and I believe in the Prophet Muhammad. The day that I converted, I actually went to a weekend intensive course taught by two prominent American Muslim scholars. But what really struck me was when the scholar said, and I also believe in the Prophet Jesus and the Virgin Mary. So for me, when I said my Shahada, my declaration of faith, and he added that, it was powerful because I finally felt like I believed in them the right way. I believed in the Prophet Jesus, peace be upon him, and the Virgin Mary.
Was the experience for you, Hamza, different because of the fact that you had, you know, you had been struggling, you were selling drugs, you were doing drugs? Was the experience like, se salvó, thank God that he found the God of Islam?
Yeah, people were just in state of shock. Like, just, we went from selling drugs to walking down the street, you know, dressed in like what they thought was dresses. And people were saying, what's going on? Mira, ¿qué le pasa a Jason? Because my government name is Jason. And my mom be like, mija, déjalo quieto. Tiene un traje. He looks like an Arab, but I see him praying all the time, you know. And it was a big shock for the people in the neighborhood.
But you know what? Maria, I have found that most of us go through a three-stage process. The first one being an initial rejection, then to a it's okay time frame. And then it evolved to people being sympathetic to you. Like my mother's initial, I'm not going to talk to him for some months. It transformed to even in Christmas, me receiving as a gift, a praying rug.
So the perception is that Islam is an experience that is going to be somewhat limiting. You become somewhat restrained. You know, there is a modesty. There is the, you know, not necessarily touching other people, the head covering. And, you know, the perception among Latinos is that we're very open. So put these two, you know, perceptions, put them together in terms of your lives.
I can say that a lot of those things are passionate things that have to deal with our passions. And perhaps people who don't know how to control themselves are prisoners to their passions. In Islam, we become free by controlling our passions and not becoming slaves and prisoners to what our passions command us to do.
We just discover a whole new world on how to exchange with our friends, with our families. You can really feel happy without introducing alcohol to a party. And that is something that in our culture, we are only taught that, hey, if there's no alcohol in a party, there's really not a party.
Being a Latina and a Muslim is not a dichotomy. And that needs to be something that everybody understands. Unfortunately, we live in a society where Latinos have a particular stereotype, right? We're all gangbangers. We're all drug dealers. We all have babies by the time we're 16. That is such a disgusting stereotype that the media really portrays of our people.
To all three of you, I say shukran. Thanks for joining us on Latino USA for the beginning, I think, of a pretty wonderful conversation.
Muchas gracias.
Blessings.
Thank you.
Stay in peace.
Hazel Gomez is a community organizer who joined us from the studios of WDET in Detroit. Hamza Perez is an activist who joins us from the studios of WESA in Pittsburgh. And Wilfredo Amer Ruiz is an attorney, political analyst, and Muslim chaplain who joined us from the studios of WLRN in Miami. Coming up on Latino USA, Eduardo G. Carvalho, truck driver by day, accordion whiz by night.
Especially here when everybody else went to the music school and they just do it, you know, it's more like a very authentic thing.
That's coming up on Latino USA. No se vayan.
Fuego, oh, oh.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. No holiday weekend is complete without a little party music, so we bring you a bit of the tropics with the sounds of Brazilian forró. This high-energy dance sound comes from the country's northeast and came to fame in the 1940s, but it remains alive and vibrant today in Brazil and in the U.S. Reporter Marlon Bishop brings us this story of forró from Newark, New Jersey.
The bar is colorfully painted, hot, and packed to the gills. Couples twirl to the sound of wailing accordion and tittering triangle. In a miracle of human geometry, the dancers tangle up and unfurl themselves with complex turns. Marília Oliveira, an au pair from Brazil, can hardly believe it.
I just forgot that I'm in America. Everything here in this space is so Brazilian. So it's great to have a place to come here in New York to listen to some Brazilian music.
It's the weekly Sunday afternoon party at Miss Favela, a Brooklyn restaurant named after Brazil's notorious shanty towns. The band is called the Fulanos, and the music they play is forró. It's Brazil's answer to salsa, a partner dance that's difficult to master, set to an up-tempo, syncopated beat. Recently, forró has been going through a resurgence, especially in dance communities in the U.S. and Europe, that are discovering it for the first time. Like many musicians that play Brazilian gigs in New York City, the Fulanos are actually from New Jersey. The Ironbound District in the city of Newark was once a run-down industrial neighborhood. But immigrants from Portugal and its former colonies settled here and made it bloom.
There is a strong presence of Brazilian culture here. A lot of people speak the Portuguese everywhere.
This is Gil Oliveira, percussionist for the Fulanos. Instead of the shuttered storefronts you see everywhere else in Newark, the Ironbound's Ferry Street is packed with Brazilian nightclubs, Portuguese bakeries, Cape Verdean barbershops.
So it feels like you are in a small town of Brazil.
This area, known as Little Brazil, is also home to accordionist Eduardo de Carvalho. Eduardo grew up in a family of cattle farmers in southern Brazil, a region with lots of German and Polish heritage, and thus lots of accordions. He remembers going to a local dance as a boy and loving the accordion the moment he heard it. That night, he picked up an old one his father had lying around the house.
As soon as I got home, nobody sleep about 3 or 4 days, trying to play.
And play he did. Eduardo discovered he had a serious ear for music. He could pick up any tune right away and soon became an accomplished player without any training or theory. By day, Eduardo's a truck driver, beefy, muscular, serious, kind of a strong, silent type. But get him behind an accordion and he's a totally different guy. Eduardo is 38. At age 23, he was training to be a flight attendant and came to the U.S. to learn English. He decided to drop out of school and stay, but he didn't know anybody here and had a hard time getting by. That's when he started driving trucks and all but gave up on music.
Because I had no time for the accordion, you know. Sometimes I had to work in the night times on Fridays, on Saturdays and Sundays. That's where they won the accordion to make the big parties.
Then he met Gil Oliveira, the forró percussionist. Gil was interested in drawing connections between the people playing the fancy venues in Manhattan and those at the down-home bars in Newark. He was impressed by Eduardo's raw, unvarnished talent.
Especially here when everybody else went to the music school and everybody knows a lot. So like even before they play, they're already like writing and thinking. And he's more like... He just do it, you know, it's more like a very authentic thing.
At a friend's house in Newark, Eduardo and Gil go over music for an upcoming gig here in town. He still drives his truck, but he's taking fewer shifts so he can play accordion on the weekends. He says it's a big sacrifice.
Oh yeah, because the truck gives him money, a lot of money. Not really a lot of money, but, you know, I can survive. I can give some comfort for my family.
But just watch him pumping the bellows furiously at Miss Favela as the crowd hollers in adoration and you can see it's worth it for him. Eduardo G. Carvalho and his accordion were just kind of meant to be together.
Thank you, everybody, for coming. Today is Favela. See you guys next Sunday. Tefulanos. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, everybody. Thank you very much.
For Latino USA, I'm Marlon Bishop.
Hello.
And finally, as you probably know, the Statue of Liberty is not a native New Yorker. So here goes a little bocadito. She was a gift to the United States from the people of France. Unfortunately, though, for some people, the only real Americans are the ones that are born on U.S. soil. So what if we treated one of the country's most famous immigrants the way we treat an undocumented immigrant?
I need an exact date, ma'am. Can I see your entry papers?
I don't have any.
Well, do you have some other form of identification, something showing when and how you came to the United States?
I came here in some crates by boat. They didn't give me any documents when I arrived.
No papers.
So can you imagine deporting the Statue of Liberty? That's the idea presented in a new video from two activist organizations, Breakthrough Media and the Yes Lab. In the video, an immigration official sits at his desk very officially, tossing questions at a very confused Lady Liberty. Of course, she answers in English with a very thick French accent.
What do you do for work? Do you have any proof of employment?
For over a century, I have welcomed and inspired new Americans to this country. I am an icon of American freedom.
Can you prove you are not taking a job away from an educated American statue?
To see the whole video deporting the Statue of Liberty, visit our website at latinousa.org. And for this week, that's Latino USA. Please become our amigos. You can friend us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter, and you can also spot us on Tumblr. Our program is produced by Carolina Gonzalez, Deborah George, Lita Hartman, AC Valdez, Daisy Rosario, Diana Montaño, Miguel Simon Johnson, and Michael Jones. We had additional help this week from Jay Larson at WDET in Detroit, Helen Wigger at WESA in Pittsburgh, and Peter Mayers at WLRN in Miami. Latino USA is produced by The Futuro Media Group in Harlem. Our program was founded at the University of Texas at Austin, and I'm executive producer Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week for another edition of NPR's Latino USA.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all. And the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. Squeeze Play is supported in part by the NALAC Transnational Cultural Remittances, National Association of Latino Arts and Cultures, the Ford Foundation, and Southwest Airlines. Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Lumber Liquidators, offering a variety of sustainably harvested flooring, including pre-finished and stained, at 1-800-HARDWOOD. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Pew Charitable Trusts, working to help states make evidence-based policy and budget decisions at pewtrusts.org. This is NPR.